What up, everybody? It's your boy Joel, live from the 718 in Queens for another episode of the Global Citizen Podcast. I hope everybody had a great holiday and they are ready for a powerful 2016. I know I am. I finished 2015 with a bang to the point where I'm doing a dryuary where I'm just not drinking for the month of January. I'm just trying to start off pure. Today, we have a special guest on the Global Citizen Podcast. My guest is Marlon Peterson, who is a national social and criminal justice advocate, a writer, organizational trainer, community organizer, and educator who spent 10 years in the New York State's prisons. Marlon is the founder and chief of Reimaginator of the Precedential Group, a social justice consulting firm. He is also a 2015 recipient of the prestigious Soros Justice Fellowship. His writings have appeared in Ebony, Gawker, The Crime Report, Black Press USA, The Broken Reader, and he was featured in the internationally acclaimed blog Honey Humans of New York. He is also a recipient of the Ebony Power 100, which is an award honoring the heroes of the Black community. Marlon is a sought-after public speaker and workshop facilitator who speaks at colleges, universities, and community forums. And most importantly, he is from and lives in Brooklyn, New York. Slow clap, Marlon. Welcome to the show, man. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks. That's a long bio there.
It's a long bio, but it's impressive, man. It's really, really impressive. I mean, ever since I've met you, you have just kind of like impressed me from day one. You know, when I first met you, I'm like, oh, this dude's cool. And I started to, you know, to get to know you. And just kind of hear about your story, and I'm just like, wow, you've accomplished a lot, and I feel like you've packed it in. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do exactly?
I do a lot. I mean, I try to do people work. So I call people work. So ultimately, consultancy called the Presidential Group, and you know, the tagline is, you know, create justice through community and consultancy, and largely it's looking at ways to improve the way organizations serve people who may come from different marginalized spaces. So whether it be people who, organizations that serve people who are incarcerated, organizations that work with young men of color, young women of color, organizations that work around issues of racial justice, you know, provide assistance and, you know, some organizational support around those sort of issues. But along with that, I mean, there's so many, and that, so that comes from the consultancy side, that has to creating justice to community, through community and consultancy. So the community part of it is, we do a lot of youth empowerment workshops around the city, around the country, and then largely around issues of gun violence, which is something that's very close to me, personal to me, and also around different ways to look at ways to improve our communities that are not so heavily reliant upon law enforcement. And so, I mean, so in a nutshell, that is what I do. And I do a lot of that through advocacy, and also through my writing.
How do you learn how to do all those things? You know, I think a lot of people really want to kind of start their own thing where they want to do something positive in their community, or they just want to start their own business. But just kind of being able to be a jack of all trades, it can be a really, you know, overwhelming thing. I mean, how'd you really kind of start where you're like, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to do it. Here's the blueprint.
Well, my idea is to be a master of all trades, you know, because I think that when you think of a jack of all trades, what comes after that is a master of none. So, I mean, you know, my aim is to be like a master of all trades. And, I mean, the way, see, that's an interesting question, like how, you know, how did I learn this, all this sort of stuff? So, you know, you mentioned I spent 10 years in prison. This was released 6 years ago, 2009. And a lot of it began in there. I did a lot of writing in there, but I also started programs while I was in the prison, so I'm in there. And I think that was my training ground to prepare me to be able to do the work that I do now. So, I mean, it started in prison. But that's where it began. It's just so thankful and blessed to have support that when I came home, that I was able to sort of like continue right into it. And then also, with that support, helped me to adjust to another, just to being in the community again after being away for so long. And that just that sort of support helped me find ways to transition, you know, the skills and talents and abilities that I had.
Okay. So you said that, you know, it really started when you were in prison. Can you talk about how that actually happened? How is it that you were arrested, and how is it that you were in prison for such a long time?
So I was arrested when I was 19. Just 12 days before my 20th birthday in 1999. I played a role as a lookout in a crime that was attempted robbery that resulted in a double homicide. A horrific crime here in New York City. So initially, I ended up with myself and four other folks who were arrested for the crime. So initially I was charged with first degree murder. So, and you know, when you are, it's called a felony murder charge. So because you were in a place and you're about to commit a felony, which is robbery, and a homicide happened, you're charged with everything. Even though I never pulled a gun, never held a gun that day or anything like that. I wasn't even in the same store where the crime happened. So we were all charged with first degree murder, so I was facing life in prison. They weren't bluffing, they weren't joking. And I spent about almost 3 years without bail. You can say fighting case. And eventually, I was, took a plea of 12 years, took a 12-year sentence. And I lived in 12 years in New York State, you do 85% of the time. So I did 10 years out of, 10 years, 2 months and 7 days of that time, of the 12 years that I did. And I should say also that, prior to that crime, prior to that arrest, the only time I was arrested before was for, hopping the turnstile in New York. So there's, no long history of, interaction. Well, no long history of arrest from the police or no long history of crime or criminality. But either way, though, even though, this was an aberration, it was a huge aberration. I paid daily for it. But beyond what I paid, there's so many other people that have paid and are still paying for, those decisions on, 16 years ago, 17 years ago, excuse me. So in a nutshell, that's how I ended up going to prison and spending that much time there.
When you were there, what did you do to kind of, what was your activity or your thought process that kept you Marlon, that kept you grounded? I'm sure you went through a lot of change mentally while you were there, but, you were a kid when you went to jail. And, what were you able to kind of put yourself in a place mentally where you were able to grow or able to kind of clear your mind? Or was it, a rough patch in the beginning or a rough patch throughout? Because you're doing so much for the community now. And it sounds like you did a lot for the community within prison. But, what did you do to kind of just stay grounded and kind of stay positive and kind of have hope?
Well, it's all, phases for me. When I first went in, I was a kid. And I was usually, the youngest person anywhere where I was housed at. So, initially, what I, basketball. Every day you get an hour to play ball. So, whether it was freezing outside, and I had to move the snow, or it was warm outside, I'd play basketball, and that's sort of was the place I would let go a lot of my frustrations, honestly. But after that, one of the things, once I sort of settled in, if you want to call that, in terms of prison, I started writing to myself. I started a journal. And I think that journal played a big role in helping me deal with a lot of other frustrations and fears and uncertainties and insecurities. It was like my place of refuge. And that journal sort of, got me through my bit, but as I said, with Steve, along with that journal, I didn't say that prior to, when I was a kid, I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness, when I was a kid, when I went back, I sort of went right back to, I was attracted back to looking into the Bible and You know, and I really did study the Bible for a couple of years. I always, you know, I stay, most people don't know that, but, you know, I read the Bible two times, but just back to back.
Wow.
From cover to cover, I mean, and then the third time, I literally study every book of it. And I was, like, really, you know, and that grounding faith and religion played a big role in my life for the first, I would say, five years of my experience, prison experience. So, like, the first 3 years, I mean, first 5 years of my prison experience would include basketball, journaling, and, you know, religion. And then I think that the second half, the shift came when you're maturing. I think that as you mature, you learn more about yourself, even in those spaces. But you also learn your perspective on life adjusts to the information you always had. So by that, even my relationship with religion sort of shifted as I got older and I started just like seeing things differently. So I didn't like because I was against religion, but I just thought differently, and it was something that I gravitated to as much. But I gravitated to other things. So the journaling was still there, basketball was still somewhat there. But the next thing that came in was my ability to like really help other people through other talents. So, you know, it's a piece that I wrote that was published, the first piece that I published on Gorka.com, which is that sort of speaks about, you know, a writing correspondence program that was called the Young Scholars Program that I had with some of the 7th and 8th grade students in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And that program that I started with a friend of mine who was a teacher at the time at the school, you know, allowed me to correspond with young people up to maybe 50 kids every 2 weeks and, you know, write a curriculum and individually respond to them through their teacher. And they would write me letters back and forth. And that experience did a couple of things for me. One is it really informed my next 5 years of my bid, but definitely informed my now even. But along with that, it gave me a sense of relevance. I think, you know, in prison does everything to, like, take away your feeling of, like, humanity. It does everything it can to take away your sense of worth and individuality. And that program, writing those kids, as much as I was helping them, they helped me really, really get to my humanity and see it and accept it in many ways. To help me see a sense of relevance that I can, like, that people care about what I have to say, and they valued it, and that's the antithesis of what prison does for you. So, for the, you know, the latter half of my bid through that program, I started working in a program they had within the facility called Transitional Services, where, you know, we pretty much facilitated classes for the men in the facility. You know, provided one-on-one counseling, provide resumes, facilitated classes, and I ended up running, like, there was the staff, incarcerated men that were there, all older than me. So I was still the youngest person in a lot of places. And I ended up running the program for the last, like, 4 years of my time in prison. So I was really counseling, you know, facilitating classes. I started a program, or enhanced the program with a college, brought college students into the prison and, you know, into an experiential dialogue with the men, incarcerated men every week. So, I mean, that occupied my last 4 or 5 years of prison. So the transition in 2009, I would often say it was often seemingly transitionless because I literally, within a month of me being home, I had a program in a school in Brownsville, Brooklyn, for young boys. So it literally, like, was transitionless. I just sort of continued what I was doing inside.
You talk about the kind of the program you have with the students in Brooklyn, and I read that Gawker article, and I thought it was really amazing, man. And I could see how the kids, the letters that were shown in the article, how they're already gravitating towards you. You had one girl who was telling you about her dating. I wouldn't call them issues, but just her dating kind of situation. You had some students who did show that they were upset that you were there, but at the same time they forgave you all at the same time. And I could definitely see how that can kind of help you plan ahead. Were you able to meet any of those students afterwards, or was this kind of just like after that? I believe it was a 4 month program. You kind of just, it was over after that.
Yeah, people often ask that. So I only met one of the kids when I came home, and that was just by coincidence. So no, I never was able to meet the young people. You know, I would never write those children directly, so we always go through to the teacher.
Right.
And she would get the letter to them, so I didn't, like, write to their houses and anything like that, and they didn't have my information right to me directly. So, because when they wrote their letters, they would give them all to the teacher, and the teacher would put them all in a manila envelope packet and email and send them to me from the school's address. So by the time I came home, and that program lasted about a year and a half, so by the time I came home, those children, those kids had moved on, and I lost contact with them.
Got you.
I still have every one of their letters. Every one of their letters individually, I still have in its original form in my apartment.
That's what I was going to ask you next. So you had the letters, but what about the journal? So you said you wrote a lot in your journal. Were you able to keep that journal or the journals?
Yeah, I have books and books and books and books of journals in my house too. I have every one of my journal entries, just about every one of my journal entries from inside. I brought those home. Those are the things I know I needed to bring home with me. There's so many other things I got rid of, but definitely want to keep those things.
Do you ever sit back and read them? Like, if you're having a rough day, do you ever just kind of like look through and just be like, you know, let me see kind of where your mind was at?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It still does when you look back on those things. I mean, they still inform a lot of the work that I do now. You know what I mean? You know, when prison, you know, it can do a lot of things to you. And I think despite all the things prison can do to you, I was able to use that time to really, like, think about, like, not only prison issues that affected me personally as a person, as an incarcerated person at the time, but also issues of the community and our neighborhood and our nation. And so I also wrote things that have been published outside media magazines while I was inside. So, you know, some of the stuff that I wrote in those journals informed, like, literally today I sent an email out to somebody regarding something I wrote in a story I want to write about Obama and criminal justice, something that started while I was inside. So I definitely go back to read it. But also read it to kind of, like, make this kind of, like, hit for me to see, for to reflect on the mood that I was, what I was going through. And that reflection of those moments sort of helped me deal with, you know, the same struggles I have now, being able to sort of see how I dealt with things back then and where my mindset was back then. It helps me sort of kind of get past and cope with the different sort of struggles that I have now.
Got you. One of the things that really upset me, and people always advise not to do this, specifically off that Gawker article you wrote, I looked at the comment section, and I always look at the comment section. I shouldn't. But you read the comment section, and, you know, look, people are allowed to have an opinion, but some of these opinions were just so, like, just barbaric and just mean, and just it means it's just like a kid word to use, but just kind of, it came from such a negative and evil place, you know? And I'm like, they're writing this about this person that I know, but even if I didn't know you and I was reading those, especially the, you know, the Gawker article about the pen pal program you had, I'd be like, this person is coming from a good place. But I mean, what do you do when you kind of come across people who feel that you know you're doing whatever you're doing to use it to your advantage, or that, you know, or the people that believe in the mindset that, you know, you commit a crime, you go to prison, and you deserve to be there forever. I mean, Do you deal with people like that? Because right now you deal with pretty much a very high level of folks. By high level, I mean people who have access, important folks. And then you rub elbows with people who are a big deal. And I'm sure that some of them do share some of the same sentiment that I've read in those comment section. I mean, how do you deal with that? I mean, do you run across people like that? And how do you deal with that? Do you kind of just sit back and not say anything, or do you try to educate, or do you push back? I mean, what's a way for you to deal with that?
Well, you know, you don't give ignorance too much attention, right? That's one thing. You know, when that's the first like art I had published, you know, on a wide scale, I think, after I was released. And I made the mistake of reading the comment section. And I think initially it put me in a place of kind of depression when I first read the comments. It had me rethinking a little bit. Like, you know, I learned from that experience not to read the comment section, because people will say what they want to say. People have a mouth and they will use it for good or what, or for good or bad. But I think now, so even though I'm in this place now, I get to maybe rub elbows with different folks, I'm still a dude from Brooklyn. So just 3 months ago, police stopped me driving a car 3 blocks from my neighborhood, and the first thing they asked me when they stopped me was like, "Are you on parole or probation?" You don't stop anything. That's not, you don't do that, right? You don't do that. So you know, that's not in their, that's not in their, in their handbook to stop people from asking them for probation. And then I'm not even giving me a ticket or anything like that. So I mean, I still, and then after that, they asked me that, they went and read my record and said, well, who did you kill and who did you stab? And like, they just read my rap sheets all over again. It had nothing to do with them stopping for, they just said they stopped it because I switched lanes without signal. Apparently, coincidentally, the same thing they stopped Sandra Bland in Texas.
Yeah.
But, so I still deal with that, right? I think that as a black man in this country, like, you don't, like, not deal with that anymore. Right, and you just don't, unless you happen to be a celebrity living in the hills of Hollywood, and maybe you may still deal with it then. So I haven't gotten past it. I think the way that I'm able to cope with it, when I said that I read those things that I've written years ago, I mean, prison was power, and I dealt with that every day with police, with, well, officers, treating us like less than human. And, you know, one of the places I said I would deal with, one of the ways I would deal with my frustration by writing, like, I had to put it someplace, because if I last it out, I would probably still be there right now, be dead, right? So, you know, one of the reasons I can look back, why I look back on the things I've written back then, is to give me a certain sense of sustenance and strength to deal with what I'm dealing with now, because of more freedom, because of more responsibilities. It's much easier to lash out now and probably even get away with it, right?
Mm.
But it's not, you know, it's not beneficial to me, but it's also not beneficial to the community of people that I care about. Right, I'm not saying that, like, I'm, like, Jesus Christ on the cross, and I'm going to let somebody put some nails on my head. But I'm also saying that, sadly, that's what we have to deal with. And it's a body who has, as a black person, but also as somebody who has served time for this more violent crime, you know, people tend to be very unforgiving, but they also tend to be very ignorant as to the humanity of people. And so that's largely the forms of work that I do, right? Is that I'm always seeking to show the humanity in people, no matter who they are. Largely, can always show the humanity in folks. Because there's no one any good to match the inhumanity of other folks with more inhumanity. So, you know, I would say I don't pay attention to those folks in those comment sections.
No, I mean, that's a great thing, and. You know, I don't blame you for reading the comment section. We all slip up and do it. it was craziness. Let me ask you this before I ask you about, you know, once you left. I just want to hear a little bit. What was life like, you know, early life? What was like your teenage years growing up in Brooklyn? I mean, the 90s, that was when the Knicks were good. But, you know, what was it like, you know, what was it like growing up? I mean, Did you, you know, I'm sure you did normal things as a teenager, but what was it like growing up in Brooklyn? What was Brooklyn like? Because New York has changed a lot through the years. You know, I know the area you lived in, Crown Heights. Crown Heights is turned to hipster, is turned to hipster. NA Rocks turned to hipster hell. And I'm sure that once you, you know, started living in Brooklyn again, I'm sure you were kind of taken aback of where New York is going.
That question, I hear silence in the background.
Yeah.
Did you plan that?
It's Queens, man. It's live and raw, yo. There ain't no studios here. We doing this from a treehouse.
That's what Brooklyn was like. Nah. I'm from Crown Heights. Originally, was from Ocean Avenue. You know, we call it NA Rock back in the days, and it was really tough back in the 80s as a kid. I lived on Ocean Avenue, Pacific Street for like the first 11 years. Me and my five other family members in a one-bedroom apartment. But inside my apartment, it was a great place for the most part. You know what I mean? There was no violence there. There was no drugs, anything like that. It's just that once you walked outside of apartment 4B, you know, you saw everything. You had people, you know, crack was king in Houston. You know, I saw it. And people smoking crack. People one day, they were like 200 pounds. A couple weeks later, like a buck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was probably something like you saw often and seen different kinds of crack vials all over the streets. But, I mean, kind of growing up into my own teenage years, and I moved a little bit, you know, further up in the Crown Heights. You know, they call it Brow Talk now. They used to call it BCM back in the days. Brooklyn was tough, right? Brooklyn was tough. There's nobody going to get around that, right? It was tough. And me as a teenager, I had my share of my interactions with stuff on the streets that made it, that shifted my, how I thought I needed to survive in the neighborhood, right? I grew up as a kid, a Jehovah's Witness, and it was an honor student in school and all that stuff. up until to my teenage years when, you know, some things happened to me in school, violently, in the neighborhood, that sort of made me feel, well, not in the neighborhood, something else happened to me in the city at the teenage, that in my teenage mind made me feel like I had to adjust. I had to, like, shift who I was to sort of survive in the community, in the streets. It was warped thinking now in hindsight, but as a teenager, that made sense. So for me, you know, I never became involved in gangs or anything like that, but, you know, I was definitely somebody who was on the streets and hanging out and definitely involved in things I probably should not have been involved with. That led me to the point where I was arrested when I was 19. But Brooklyn, as much as Brooklyn was like that, something about, like, the street side of Brooklyn, there was nothing better than, like, walking outside on, like, Labor Day back in the day. Because you see Labor Day now, and people think it's nuts, but people getting shot and killed. And, you know, I mean, gun violence is decreased now. Is at the lowest point in this country's history in decades. But it still felt good. There was definitely a sense of definitely danger out there. And the drug economies would largely fuel that. The demand for drugs, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But it was horrible. Like, I never felt like I needed to, like, die and want to live in Brooklyn. You know what I mean? It was definitely tough, but, like, was it better at Harlem? Was it better in the Bronx? You know, it was home to me. And part of it, as an adult now, I didn't ask this yet, but as an adult now, you know, it's different. It's different. I mean, I'm not a kid, so I don't experience the neighborhood the same way as teenagers would now even. Even as an adult now, it doesn't seem... I don't know if we're on the time limit here, but I the youth program now run, and the other day, and we took these kids out to eat in this little lounge place to get some burgers and whatnot in Crown Heights near off of Franklin Avenue. And we're sitting there, it's like a window, so you can see right out to the street, and people walk by to look right into it. And this kid, I know, he's from the neighborhood, he's about 17 now. And he was like, you know, I always seen this place, but I never wanted to walk in because, like, there's too many white people in there. I don't think that's, like, for me to be. And it's a place I should be going into. This kid lives there. He grew up in the neighborhood. And because of the shift in the demographic of the neighborhood, people who are from here feel like this place is in the neighborhood they don't belong anymore.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's a complicated issue, gentrification, but it's also, in some ways, traumatic. To folks, and I see it now. I mean, as an adult, you see, you know, I do get to rub shoulders with all these different folks and all that. But, like, I still have that feeling sometimes. Like, I ain't gonna go into that spot. I don't look like the spot I would feel comfortable going into. Cause, like, it don't look like, it just doesn't feel like it's welcoming for me.
No, I totally know what you mean. Even in the city, I was trying to watch, I think, a basketball game, and I was with my girlfriend. I'm like, let's just stop in here because I want to watch this game. She lives in Harlem, and this was this spot in the city. I think it's Fat Black Pussycat on West 4th. We walked in, man, and it just felt like a frat house. We walked in and walked right back out, and the bouncer laughed. The bouncer was this enormous black dude, and he just knew where I was. I'm like, let's just go back to Harlem. Because, you know, I just want to feel like it's a welcoming place. I want to feel comfortable. And there's some places now in New York where I feel I just don't feel comfortable. But, you know, I'm an adult, so I'll just make do and just, you know, whatever. But, you know, it's tough, like you said, a 17-year-old who's from the neighborhood who doesn't feel welcome in his or her own neighborhood.
I mean,
you
saw my fat black down in the village. The thing about that, though, I'm going to just say that, like, I expect that out there. That's from the West Village. I expect it to be different, you know, and then to have, you know, other, you know, a lot more white folks and whatnot. I expect that there. But the difference is when you're in your own neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's really something when you're in your own neighborhood and you don't feel welcome in your own neighborhood. But I didn't, you know, you're not traveling into Manhattan. If I go to Manhattan, I see that. I expect that. It doesn't bother me.
Right.
But I think when I see it in my own block, my own neighborhood, It's bothersome. I can only imagine how that affects teenagers and seniors.
Do you feel that now after your experience, you know, when you were a young man and then you spent time in prison and then kind of now the positive success you've had now, when you try to give another young person who's going through a troubling time some advice, and if they don't listen to you, well, do you have young adults who don't listen to you? Like you're telling them, look, this is what you got to do. You should think about this, and they're kind of like, you know, in one ear and out the other. Do you see that? Does that happen to you? And if you do, kind of what do you do? Do you kind of just let them go through the motions, or is there anything you do to try to make them understand that they really should consider a certain route so they don't really end up in jail or worse?
So yes, without question, teens are going to be teens, right? And teens are going to challenge authority, going to be presumptuous, going to make mistakes. So I expect that. And have I seen it yet? I mean, there's a young man I know a couple of, maybe 2 years ago. He's a work with me. He's a teenager. You know, I said, take it with me. I helped him. He helped facilitate a workshop with me amongst other teens. And you know, found out a couple months later that he's been racked down and facing life in prison.
Wow.
For gang, you know, this whole gang conspiracy. Facing that 5 years, so pretty much a lifetime in prison. And that's just one example. But here's the thing about that. What I've understood and realized in my experience, but also my personal experience, but also through observation, is that you can only, our goal is also our more experience should be to be consistent in a person's lives and to make sure that they get exposed to information you need them to get. Right? Because you can't stop them from making a mistake. You can't literally stop them. You can suggest a request, but you can't stop them from making a mistake. Just like you can stop. People suggested, people requested, but I denied. But when I got inside the belly of the beast, when I got into this prison didn't help me to transform myself. All the stuff that people were telling me before now came to my forefront, now came back to me and made sense to me and it helped me get through the next 10 years of my life.
Mm.
Right? It now made sense to me. I got it and I knew what to do. Like I got all those tools people were giving me before, and I realized I needed to use despite where I was at.
It kicked in.
Who? It helped me get through the next 10 years of my life. Mm. So I also felt like in my 10 years in prison, I never had a fight. Not one fight. I never had any beef. I also didn't join nobody's gang. I didn't become no part of a specific sect of safety or anything like that. You know what I mean? I became somebody who actualized all the advice that I was given before. And I think that as adults, you're going to deal with these young folks. You're going to deal with young folks who ain't going to listen, who might say FUG estates or whatever. And I mean, that's not good. But we should, what we can do is to make sure that at every opportunity, that we give them information they have. They may not listen to it. They may act like they may not listen to it. But if you give it to them enough, at some point, whether they accept it before something happens or something else happens that is negative, hopefully it's not 6 feet under. But hopefully at some point, that information that people are throwing to them, they get. And that's why I do the work that I do with young folks. Because I know that I can give it to you. I can give you the information. At least I have it be in you. At some point, you're going to realize why I was saying it and how to use it and how to apply it in your own life.
Mm. That's pretty deep, man. Who would you say is the one person that whose advice always stuck in your head from back, you know, people who kind of, an adult or authority figure who always used to kind of be in your ear, and then, you know, once you went through prison, their advice kind of kicked in, and once you came out, that's helping you kind of succeed today?
I think, always reflect back to some of my pops told me on the first day he visited me. It was the first time I also saw my pops cry. And I remember him, I think I was asking him something along the lines, like, how are you going to help me get out of here? I'm like begging him, like he got the keys to the gate, you know. And I remember, because at the time I saw his face in life, and I remember him saying to me, he cried while he was saying it, tearing. And he said, I just need you, Mom. I need you to learn how to become a man while you're here. I need you to learn how to take care of yourself and be responsible for yourself now. And those words may seem, I don't know, simple to so many folks. But I remember when I got it, when he said that to me, it scared me because it was the first time in my life, as much as I used to act like I'm big and grown and whatnot, you know, as a teenager, it was the first time I had realized really that my parents couldn't help me.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing they can do. Like, he's telling me at this point, like, there's, I can't, like, there's nothing I can literally do right now. There's a lawyer, and we're going to, you know, we're going to talk to the lawyer and whatnot, but there's nothing I can do. And to me, it was an awakening moment. It scared the hell out of me when he told me that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he literally took me out of the store and said, you got to walk.
Yeah.
Like, you got to walk now. Like, and I just do it. And it's traffic, the four-lane highway, but you got to figure that out. And for me, but it guided me through the next couple of years, though, because I understood the importance of the advice that he had, other people that he had given me throughout the years prior to prison. But it also gave me sort of the wherewithal to know that how to be an independent, be an individual despite everything around me. Everything around me, I had to learn how to become an individual for the betterment of my freedom. So every day, I know I needed to not do anything to extend my stay in that state. By that means, getting to some beef, some stupid beef or officers. And it came close at times, but thankfully enough, it did. And I think any time it ever did come close, those words rang in my ears.
Yeah, that's great advice and strong advice from your parents or authority figures. Always have a way of kicking in when you're in a situation. Let me ask you now. So first, I mean, this might be a long answer, but what did it feel like once you finally were released? Like, how did it feel? Were you ready for it? Were you scared? I mean, how did it feel when you walked out?
People always ask you that. I'm telling you, I can be so unemotional at times. So it felt like Wednesday, December 23rd, 2009. Like, that's the day I was released. And it really felt like it was just day after December 22nd.
Yeah.
When I was released, it was not. I didn't have this big, like, screaming, jumping up and down, crying. I'm kissing the ground. Like, my brother and sister, my nephew came to pick me up from jail. And if I walked outside, it felt good being free. Obviously, that, you know, it's done. Like, I did that. Like, that's over now. But I think I always say, you know, The biggest thing, so once again, to the work that I do. They came to pick me up from upstate New York, and eventually we got back down into the city, back into Brooklyn, and we were driving down Ocean Avenue, passing down, like, the block, the building I first grew up, was born in on Ocean Pacific, and then we rolled around to, like, you know, the block where I live now, turn on Ocean, and one of the first things I noticed was some of the same cats I either hung out with or I had beef with still there.
Yeah.
On the same corners. And that bothered me deeply, because the only thing that was different from them from 10 years before to then was that, like, they were a little bit older, their bellies a little bit bigger, their sneakers wasn't that sly. You know what I mean? Like, they aged a little bit, and they, you know, you tell, like, you know, there wasn't as, it was, life became much harder than it was when they were, like, 17, 18, 19, 20.
Right.
But it bothered me because as much as I was able to use a bad situation and shift and adjust and improve myself, despite where I was at, a lot of folks didn't and couldn't in so many ways, right? And that bothered me. It really did bother me when I saw that. And, it really fuels my work, those sort of experiences. So, I mean, when I finally got home, my pops was there, you know, I ate some food, and I was chilling in the house. I remember saying that, you know, before I was released, people, my parent, my nephew and other people were asking, like, what do you want? You want this? You want to get you so much clothes? You want that? And I was like, listen, all I need is a computer. Just give me a computer. That's all I want.
MacBook Pro.
And that's I got a Dell computer. I ain't get no MacBook. It wasn't up there yet. But I got a PC. And I ain't know how to use it. You know what I mean? I ain't know. But, you know, through help and me just kept teaching myself, I learned. And that computer, like, it's like, you know, that's what I needed to, like, get my life together, you know, and I'm thankful. That was the gift I needed.
Yo, man, you are seriously, like, one of the most positive people I've met. Really, like, you know, within the past, like, 5 years, you are nothing but positivity. And one of the things that really impressed me is, like, once we, you know, did meet each other, you were in the process of completing your bachelor's at NYU. Is this something you told yourself you would do, that I'm going to get a college degree, I'm going to go to this school, or did someone kind of have to motivate you? I mean, it just seems that, you know, when if someone meets Marlon Peterson is very put together, you know, you always talking about the next thing you're gonna do. And at the time, you know, you're already working. You know, I met you through Families for Freedom, but you were also completing your bachelor's at NYU. And like, when did you tell yourself, like, this is gonna happen? Like, no matter what, I don't care. You know, what the situation is. Once I'm out, this is going to happen.
So I got an associate's degree while I was inside. I got a criminal justice degree while I was still inside. And I just finished paying it off until like 2 years after I came home. But I think the NYU joint, I had got accepted straight because of the work I did with the college inside, a college upstate New York called Vassar College.
Mm-hmm.
They accepted me into a summer intensive program in the summer of 2010. And it was just like, get some credits for it, some college credits, and, you know, go about your business. And I was there, and I remember there was a girl, one of the classmates, she was, you know, in it. And I remember looking on her laptop, and she had, like she said, she's applying to Columbia and NYU. And I remember looking at it, and like, they were foreign to me. I mean, I didn't know what Columbia University was. You know what I mean? I just wasn't in my thought process. I didn't know where it was. And I didn't know, I knew NYU was in Manhattan, but I didn't know where, even though I was somebody that always went through, like, the West Village area, I just never knew NYU was there. So it never seemed like some place available to me. So I remember saying, like, well, why are you going to apply? And my response was like, how? I knew I wanted to go to college because I knew I wanted to get a bachelor's degree, but I thought I would go to, like, you know, training school, which is great in itself, right? It still is good. But, you know, she introduced the idea to me, and I remember when the summer program was over, you know, I think she sent me a link to, like, orientation. You know, a link to orientation, and I went to orientation, and I was like, oh, shit, well, you can just, like, apply. Like, you know what I mean? Just apply. I just thought it had a special, smart, I don't know, I didn't know that was something available to me. And I applied, and I got into there, and I got into Vassar College. I got into both of them. And the only thing that I always say, this is the sad part of it, is that, I mean, I decided not to go to Vassar, even though I had a free ride.
Wow.
I'm still paying for NYU now. But,
oh, God. We all paying Sallie Mae. Sallie Mae staring at me right now.
But I'm done with Sallie Mae's government that's in my pocket.
Okay.
Anyways, but here's the one thing, though. When I was accepted to NYU, and I finished my associate degree with like a 3.8 or something like that. I was really, did really good. And I had a bunch of, you know, from the basketball, I got a bunch of nice college reference letters, professors and all that. And I, you know, wrote an essay and all that stuff was good. And I remember I was accepted, but I was in the letter, I was accepted, but then I got another letter in the mail, sort of like, well, before we like confirm your acceptance, we need to like meet with you first. And so, you know, schedule the time, I went up to the school and I walk into the room and they're like asking me questions about like where I was at those 10 years.
Mm.
And they asked me questions as if I was like, we're trying to test to see who you really are. And that bothered me, obviously. I mean, I guess I answered the question the right way. But to me, that was hugely problematic and discriminatory. I'm pretty sure they don't ask the thousands of freshmen or new students, new admissions coming to school every year to have an individual meeting with them.
Right.
Right? And they had to have an individual meeting with me, despite the grades, the letters, the references.
It wasn't enough for them.
They still didn't trust me.
Hmm.
Or trust why I would be on a college campus. Because, of course, people coming from prison to go to college and, like, shoot up the college, but they want to get accepted first before they shoot it up. I mean, I don't know what the logic would be, right? That's me being sarcastic, but, like, that was largely problematic for me. And, I mean, even a place like NYU, which is largely white, a very white space, most private universities are, and definitely not a space that's accepting the people like me. That was another sort of struggle to deal with, you know, somebody who's a black man in a space who's also formerly incarcerated and kind of like trying to navigate these spaces. And me, sometimes even trying not to let people know everything about me because I didn't want to deal with that in the school.
Right.
As a 30-something-year-old adult.
Right. Man. Well, regardless, you graduate from NYU. So let me ask you this, and you might deny this, but I want to ask, when did the kind of the success start coming? Like, when did the success start coming, and when were you kind of able to accept, like, you know, this is happening to me, all these good things are happening to me?
When I was able to success, like when success was coming in?
Yeah, I mean, so, I mean, when I was reading through your bio for the audience to hear again, I mean, you know, you're recipient of the Ebony Power 100, you won a Justice Fellowship with Soros, you've been published in so many of these kind of well-known publications. You know, you've had great ideas to start consulting companies. You're a respected community organizer. You know, you're known on the national level. You know, you're not just a person that people around the way know. You know, if someone Googles your name, it pops up many, many times, and it shows everything that you've accomplished. So I just wanted to say, when did, like, kind of the first thing happen where you were like, you know, not that necessarily that you're onto something, but what you were doing was good and you was going in the right direction. And were you able to kind of accept that?
You know, that's a good question. Thanks for asking that. Honestly, I think the Ebony Award about a month ago was the first time I felt like, yeah, I deserve that. Like, I accept that. You know, I remember getting an email from them, and at first I was surprised as hell. I was like, why is this, like, a mistake? but that was the first time that I think, and all the things I've been doing, even over the years, that I felt like I deserved. And by that, I mean, not that I felt like I was, like, fronting or anything like that, but that it's something about, like I said, that the work that I do, I call it people work. And there's something about just doing it because it needs to be done. You know what I'm saying? Like, because, like, even while I was inside, that I would say things like, I have a particular, even inside, there's so many folks who didn't have the support that I have, but I had a family. I knew I was getting a visit at least every 3 months. 2-3 months, I'd get a visit, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, I had somebody to call. And those things helped you a lot, tremendously, dealing with the craziness and humanity of prison. And, you know, someone who excelled in school as a young kid. So, like, when I was in those programs, running those programs inside, I would even say to myself, like, I'm doing it because, like, I have a particular set of gifts and I need to be, like, sharing. You know what I mean? So I was just doing it because, like, I have it. Like, why I need, like, people need it. So me, when I came home, you know, I was just doing it because it was me. It was a need for it, and I liked it, and I loved it. So when the accolades would come or when the recognition would come, I would usually be surprised, like, why is this coming? I mean, like, what am I getting this for? This is what I, you know, I'm just doing it.
Right.
Like, I'm waking up in the morning, nobody gives me a award for taking a shower. You know what I mean? And it wasn't, I said honestly, it wasn't until the Ebony joint a month ago that I was like, a word, like, yeah, this is that. Like, yeah, I deserve that. And even when I went to Ebony, ironically, I should say this, the teacher who I did the program with, the writing correspondence program with, also was honored by Ebony. Coincidentally,
wow.
Like, we didn't even know until, like, the day before. It's like, I'm going to LA, and she's like, I am too. I'm like, what you going there for? Ever? I'm like, but what? I'm here too for that sticky thing. And she, but, you know, I went out there, and being in LA, the first time I ever going out that far in this country, and being in Hollywood, and being around all these famous folks, and red carpet, and, you know, to me, what I got out of that experience was that I have even more responsibility.
Mm.
You know, there's a platform now, and, you know, I'm in a magazine, and, you know, I'm in all this sort of stuff, and, like, now it's more responsibility. It doesn't mean, like, well, yep, I did it. Like, I made it. Like, yes, I saw Brooklyn, we did it. You know
no.
what I mean? Like,
yeah.
it ain't there. Like, there's even more responsibility now because there's so many other folks who not here. And there's so many of my folks who are still inside who could do the same thing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, some of these folks inside can still do the same thing. You know what I mean? So it ain't like I'm some exception or something like that. I just had the opportunities. You know, I was able to take advantage of them. But, like, I don't do it for success. You know what I mean? Let me say this. I do anything that I do because it's important. Like, we need to be able to contribute to this planet. Whatever gift skills you got, whatever you can do, like, you got it because other people need it. Other people need some of that. You know what I mean? So, like, anything I do, like, success comes. For me, success comes is I don't go after the success. I just go after the caring. And I guess sometimes some people look around and be like, oh, shoot, he deserves some success. But I mean, like, you know, I'm just thankful. I'm just blessed, kid. Like, word up. Like, I'm just, like, happy that, like, you know, I get to be able to contribute to the plans that I do. And then I'm here. Like, I'm here. Like, I could not be here right now. And I'm not saying that as some sort of, like, cliche. You know, the first offer the DA gave me was a 40-year slap. And he said it to me like, that's a deal. I'm going to give you 40 years. So I don't say that. Anyway, I literally could not be here. My co-defendant, who I just went to visit a couple weeks ago, got 50 years to life.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And so, so like, when I say I could not be here, I don't say that in jest. I could not. He went to trial. I decided I was not going to go to trial. You know what I mean? And he got convicted and go to trial. You know, they give you everything that they can give you. You know what I mean?
They threw the book
and
at
so,
him.
So I'm thankful, bro. Like, I'm really just thankful that I get to do the stuff that I get to do.
Yes, indeed, man. Marlon, thanks a lot, man. This was really great. I'm happy that hopefully on this platform people will hear more about your story and check out all the great work that you've done. Do you have anything you want to plug?
Really quick, so one thing I'm working on is a project called Child Safe Zones, and it's really looking at ways to, as I said, to approach gun violence, address the core of gun violence, which is the under-resourced community. So I'm working on that project now through the justice grant that I got, scholarship that I got, referrals. And I'm always looking for support for that. It's called Child Safe Zones. You go on the website, Presidential Group, and you just click the link, Child Safe Zones. And I think that's about it. I mean, I'm looking for support there and ideas and whatnot to help it happen. That's about it. You know, the website, as I said, is presidentialgroup.com. So it's PRECEDENTIAL.com. Once again, PRECEDENTIAL, presidentialgroup.com. You can find out more about it there. And I got my own personal website, MarlonPeterson.com, which, like, has all the writings I put out there and a bunch of other stuff that you might want to look at. Some stuff you might want to curse at. Some stuff you might want to put some delicious stuff in the comment section. So, either way.
I'm not reading it this time. Fuck that. Well, yo, Marlon, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. We should be posting this at some point in the future. I'll let you know, and you could definitely share it with your audience. I appreciate it, man. I appreciate the work you do. I'm trying, man. I'm trying.
All right,
peace. Hey, yo, my man Fife Diggy, he got something to say. I like him brown, yellow, Puerto Rican, and Haitian. Name is Fife Dog from the Zulu Nation. So you're in the jam.